This is Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty.
And I'm Anthony Brooks. In a moment, our regular Friday Week in Review. But first, with the election less than 3 weeks away, we're going to make a brief stop along the campaign trail in the Boston mayoral race. And we're going to ask, do political endorsements matter?
Both candidates, City Councilor John Connolly and State Representative Marty Walsh, are working hard to win support in the city's neighborhoods of color, which could well determine who becomes the city's next mayor. Last week, we caught up with John Connolly as he made his case to business owners in Roxbury.
Today, we're going to spend a few minutes with his opponent, Marty Walsh, who's been collecting endorsement after endorsement from Beacon Hill colleagues to the vanquished mayoral candidates to many of the city's black religious leaders.
Because we are here to enthusiastically and with great joy endorse for mayor of the city of Boston, Marty Walsh. Come on!
This is the Reverend Jeffrey Brown, the former head of the Boston 10-Point Coalition, and the latest in a series of black religious leaders to endorse Walsh. He came here to Mattapan Square earlier this week to say that Walsh understands the challenges of this part of the city.
We have violence that continues to plague our neighborhoods. We have young people and families who are at highest risk of violence that are dealing with many of the other social ills in our community. I know by my conversations with him and the work that he's done in the community that Marty Walsh is that game-changing leader that will take Boston to the next level in the 21st century.
Brown was here with State Senator Linda Dorsina-Forey, whose district includes this neighborhood and who also endorsed Walsh.
When we have needed a reliable partner, my colleagues and I have turned to Marty Walsh because he gets it.
So Walsh has racked up an impressive run of political endorsements. Earlier this week, 21 members of the legislature's Progressive Caucus hopped on his campaign bandwagon. So have the three top mayoral candidates of color, John Barros, Felix Arroyo, and just this week, Charlotte Golar Ritchie, who placed third in the mayoral preliminary. The question is why? In a race where the two candidates seem to agree much more than they disagree on most issues, why this wave of pro-Walsh endorsements? Here's City Councilor and former mayoral candidate Felix Arroyo, who was at the Mattapan event this week.
I've worked with Marty now for years, you know, when I was an organizer at SEIU for janitors and security guards. He was steadfast in his support. I just believe that Marty's the candidate in the race most focused on bringing families out of poverty and into the middle class, which was really my focus as a candidate. And that's why, for me, it was such a natural relationship, and it was very easy for me to endorse him. And we're all working very hard to help make sure that Marty Walsh is the next mayor of Boston.
Arroyo says his endorsement of Walsh isn't necessarily a statement against Connolly. Instead, it follows a long political relationship with Walsh. The same is true for Senator Linda Dorsina-Forey, one of Walsh's longtime Beacon Hill colleagues.
Marty has shown us on Beacon Hill that he is a leader willing to take a stand on issues that may not always be popular, but it is the right thing to do, like he did on marriage equality.
John Connolly is also campaigning hard in the city's minority neighborhoods, pushing for better schools, public safety, and ways to promote minority business development. And he's won endorsements, too, but not nearly as many as Walsh, and they're not nearly as high profile. But does that really matter? Popular wisdom says political endorsements garner headlines for a day, but don't translate into many votes. In fact, endorsements can cut both ways. Connolly's supporters will tell you Walsh's endorsements make the point that he's a political insider, and they're suspicious of his cozy political relationships with close ties to Beacon Hill and the unions.
Thank you.
And public safety is one of our...
Thank you very much.
Let me have a picture with you before you leave.
Here in Mattapan, Marty Walsh posed for pictures, talked to supporters, even picked up a baby to create one of those classic campaign trail tableaus. Meanwhile, State Senator Linda Dorsina-Forey acknowledged that endorsements don't always mean a lot. But she suggested in a close race like this, with a large number of undecided voters, Support from politicians like her can help.
Endorsements are not the end-all and be-all, but let me tell you, this endorsement right here, we are going to work. We are going to work really hard for Marty, knocking on doors, letting people know why we need everyone to come out on November 5th. But now it's about the boots on the ground. Are we going to get this done? Because you know what? This is just a toss-up, right? Anything can happen.
Beyond this contest for endorsements is the question of what really separates these candidates when it comes to the issues. The question came up during this week's first debate, and I put it to Marty Walsh again in Mattapan.
One of the things that struck a bunch of people who saw the debate, there isn't a lot of daylight on the actual issues between you guys. What separates you? I mean, what's like the defining difference if someone is still struggling to make up their mind?
Well, I think for me, the difference is that I have a record of accomplishment. All of the issues that I'm talking about in this campaign, when we're talking about the schools, we have a comprehensive plan on how to continue to advance and make our schools better, close the achievement gap. And I have a record to back that up. When it comes to economic development, as far as how do you create new industry, whether it was my role as the head of the building trades by working to bring new business into Boston, or my role as a legislator to work on bringing in the high-tech, biotech industry here to Massachusetts, everything that I'm discussing, I have a record to back it up, and I think that's very different. And my opponent in this race doesn't have that same record. He has a lot of discussions about it and a lot of good buzzwords about it, but it's not about buzzwords. This election is about actually concrete ideas and concrete plans, and I have the proof to back up what I'm talking about in this race.
Seems like this election, too, is going to be decided in communities like this, where we are now, communities of color, Mattapan, parts of Dorchester, Roxbury. What's the core message to the people, the regular people?
I think, again, the core message is that I am out every day meeting people, shaking hands, talking about my message, talking about what I'm going to do as the mayor of the city of Boston. I agree with the endorsements. The endorsements, in my opinion, don't really mean a lot sometimes. But the message to the communities, particularly the communities of color in the city of Boston, the elected leaders from those communities are siding with my candidacy, Marty Walsh.
If elected mayor, the first thing you're going to do is take on the issue of violence. In neighborhoods like this.
The first meeting in the office of my office as mayor is going to be around gun violence. Too many young people are losing their lives here. We have to do something. This is an epidemic where we have young people carrying guns in fear of their life. Some of them are babies. They're pulling guns out and shooting each other. It's just not right, and we have to address that issue.
So it's been a problem for years and years. What's the first thing you'd propose to do as mayor?
I mean, the first thing I do is to have a conversation. It has been a problem for years, but there's been years where gun violence has gone down very low. And this year, unfortunately, we have an uptick in shootings. And over the years, there's been solutions that have worked. Right now, the solutions that we've tried in the last couple of years haven't worked.
Candidate for mayor of Boston, Marty Walsh, talking earlier this week in Mattapan, with less than 3 weeks to go until Election Day.
Well, that was, of course, Anthony out on the campaign trail, and last week he spoke with City Councilor John Connolly. So let's talk a little bit more about the race for City Hall, as well as the rest of the week's news. With us is Jim Sturgis, Executive Director of the Pioneer Institute. Hi there, Jim.
Hi, how are you?
Great to see you. Also, Dante Ramos, Deputy Editorial Page Editor at the Boston Globe. Dante, good to have you back as well.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah, and gentlemen, let's continue this conversation about the race for mayor and this whole issue around the endorsements. Dante, let me come to you first. First of all, why is Marty Walsh, in your view, sort of running the table on so many of these endorsements?
There's a couple of different factors that you could imagine. Some of it is personality. You hear people who don't even really agree with Marty Walsh on many issues politically, talking about how engaging a person he is, or how nice a guy he is, or how he doesn't have a lot of enemies around town. And so he certainly has a more cooperative working relationship with a lot of the other elected officials than John Connolly does. Connolly has probably more of a reputation for having sharper elbows, which is something that probably other elected officials are more sensitive to than the general public. There's also some evidence, though, that Walsh is doing a better job, resolving what looked like a potentially a problem for him. If you looked at the the map of who voted for whom on the day after the preliminary, Walsh had a lot of support in traditional white working class Reagan Democrat sort of neighborhoods, like South Boston is the classic example. And that itself can be a red flag for many minority voters. But I think the fact that Walsh is cultivating these kind of relationships with minority elected officials and making such a conscious effort to do so, I think individually these endorsements may not matter much, but collectively he certainly is helping himself. Mm.
Jim, I'd love your take on this and sort of pick up on Dante's last point there. Do they make a difference? Do these endorsements help? They certainly don't hurt, but do they help?
I think they absolutely help. I'd say a couple things. If you look at the polls and you look at the money raised, there you see that Connolly has an advantage. But you take a look at the endorsements, certainly Walsh does. And it matters, especially when you have two Irish candidates who are running citywide and you're getting endorsements from people of color in those neighborhoods. It also matters. Linda Dorsey-Nefori mentioned this. She said, we're out working hard and we have boots on the ground. That matters a ton. Money for TV ads certainly matters to some degree, but it is not nearly as effective as having people out there. Just to build on something that Dante was saying a second ago, I would also just think about the context of this election. I think anyone who looks at it and says they know who's going to win is talking out of their ears, right? And it's a toss-up. And who is the lower-risk candidate, given the support from the SEIU and other large unions that a candidate Walsh has? He's the lower risk candidate. Also, there is some history. I think that John Connolly has deeper roots in the communities of color because of his work in education for a long time. But he does have sharp elbows. Mm-hmm. And he has called out, for example, the former superintendent and said, this is not working out, folks. And I'm serious about education. I want to change that. And that did ruffle some feathers. And there are long memories in our neighborhoods.
Well, as you mentioned, it is a bit of a toss-up. We actually have a new poll from the Environmental League of Massachusetts Action Fund. WBUR's political reporter David Scharfenberg got a hold of it. And he just came around to our area and told us about it. It shows a very close race between John Connolly and Marty Walsh. Finding that Connolly has a 4-point lead in this new poll, and the margin of error is almost 4 points. So, as you said, it does look like it's a toss-up coming into these last couple weeks of the race. But we also should note that, as Anthony mentioned in his piece, there was the first of three televised debates between the candidates on Tuesday night this week. And there was some disagreement, for example, over the best way to increase home ownership in the city. Marty Walsh said that the government should be trying to help homeowners directly, and here he is.
If you look at Roxbury, 80% of the people living in Roxbury rent their apartments. I think we have to start in some cases with home ownership programs, talk to small banks to allow first-time home mortgages so folks have the opportunity to buy the home. And to do that, we need to go back and create more economic opportunities so people can get a job.
And here's John Connolly, who answered that economic development has to come first.
Well, listen, I agree on home ownership, but we're not going to be able to own a home if we can't get a great job that pays a great wage or if we can't start our business. And that's why I want to put my economic development plan into practice. And there's a few other pieces we got to focus on there. I'd like to see a Made in Boston Venture Capital Fund so that we could get lenders to pool resources and lend to businesses owned by people of color at lower rates to allow those businesses to grow and to thrive.
So, Dante, let me ask you, and Anthony's actually asked this question of both the candidates, even in those two clips, while we hear a little bit of difference between the two gentlemen, we don't hear a lot of difference between the two. And is that part of the reason why we are seeing the race sort of tightening as we approach Election Day?
What's funny about municipal elections especially, we're so used to on the national scene seeing these very sharp differences between the Republican candidate and the Democratic candidate. But even if you just look at the, not just Connolly and Walsh, but the whole field of 12 people who were running, there really weren't that many differences of opinion. There were some here and there. What felt unsatisfying to me about the debate was not so much that the two candidates were close on the issues, because we sort of knew that from the primary.
Right.
But I think that in these municipal elections, what really determines who's going to be effective as mayor or what someone's going to do as mayor, you want to know really who they're going to put in some important positions. You want to know how they're going to manage the vast cornucopia of interest groups that are at work in the city and are pressing for various things. And In the debate, when the debate is strictly about policy, especially when there's not many policy differences, you're just not really going to get a sense of what the difference between these two guys might be.
Mm. And Jim, your thoughts on that?
My thoughts are there is a direct and clear difference between the two on an economic development issue. One is talking about providing support to families to purchase something or to rent something. And one is saying, we're going to make sure you can get a job and develop businesses that are organically developed within your neighborhoods. Those are very different philosophies, and I think people should recognize that. I do think on education, there was a complete blurring of the lines in the debate, which I think is unfortunate for Connolly in particular, because he has a much stronger view about the district office. And I think the teachers who are part of unions could be flipped, as well as many parents, because there's a lot of frustration with Court Street, the district office, which has hundreds of people. But he's not gone into that too much. One final thing on the economic development issue. Joan Vernocchi had a great piece in The Globe where she's talking about everyone's focusing on the union contracts that are open. And we talked about this last month when I was on, which is a huge issue. But she also said there are big give-outs, big supports that are given to local large businesses. And that is something that does get on people's nerves, especially in the neighborhoods. And I think that's something that both of them need to address.
Let's move on. I want to talk a little bit about some local reaction to the big breakdown in governance in Washington, the failure of Republicans to extract what they wanted from President Obama and the Democrats. Lawmakers finally struck a temporary deal on the debt ceiling this week, reopened the government after the first shutdown in 20 years. So we spoke this week to Frank Adevinola. He's the Republican running for Ed Markey's old seat in the 5th Congressional District. He'll face Catherine Clark in a special election in December. While he didn't actually call himself a Tea Party candidate, he agreed with the goals, if not the tactics, of the Tea Party in Congress. Here he is.
Many people are concerned about spending from the government. And although it's very important that we keep the government working, it's also important that we compromise. And in order to compromise, we should have avoided this shutdown when, in fact, the proposal was advanced to fund the government and delay Obamacare. I would have supported that proposal.
And here's New Hampshire Republican Senator Kelly Ayotte, who said she hoped that her fellow Republicans in Congress had, in fact, learned a lesson.
I certainly hope that we've learned our lesson on this. Things have to be different because I know I hear from my constituents understandable frustration about the dysfunction in Washington. So I hope that all of our members are hearing the same thing so that they come back with a renewed sense of let's not do this again.
Jim Sturgis, what do you think? What's the lesson here? What's the result of this beyond perhaps tarnishing a bit of the GOP brand?
You know, the first thing I'd say is we probably need to distinguish between what we've called a shutdown and default. Those are two very, very distinct issues. Mm-hmm. I think governing by threatening a shutdown in government, even if it's 17-20% of the government, is no way to govern. But any body, legislative body, is within its rights in the United States, let's say, whether the Senate or the House, to pursue that. Though it is unwise politically, whichever body pursues that is usually on the losing end of a political battle. That gets sorted out in the next election. Mm-hmm. It does hurt people in the short term. I think things we should be thankful for is this did not occur in December when people may not have had heating oil as a result of this.
Yeah.
The default is something completely different, and it's really dangerous that the Republicans are playing with that. Ted Cruz in particular has, in January, he was saying, let's risk a default over a balanced budget amendment. Mm-hmm. And now it's the Affordable Care Act. It's too cavalier just to throw out, let's default, because defaults do not have immediate impacts as much as, say, a shutdown, but they have generational impacts because your credit rating is dependent upon trust, and trust means you consistently pay your bills, and you cannot throw around a default. The Republicans, frankly, should never have put the default on the table. They said, we will pay our bills and continue to press for whatever they wanted. The electorate will determine whether the Republicans are right or wrong in this. I think they probably determined they were pretty wrong.
And Dante, we have about 20 seconds left in this segment, but what's your take? What's the takeaway from this chapter in Washington?
I basically agree with Jim. I think that the one connection between the default issue and the shutdown issue is that we've had this series of episodes where all of these things essentially end up in these confrontations. And I think the fact that we've all gotten used to the sort of, the sequester debate and then the government shutdown debate gets us closer to a situation where the default actually comes into play, which is something that really would have been unthinkable a while ago.
Hmm. So, hubbubs, those stories that didn't make it above the fold this week. Let me come to you, Magna.
Okay. So, I have this track record at Radio Boston for coming to the table with the amusing animal hubbub. But today I actually have quite a somber one because there were a series of stories sort of around the media about dramatic and disturbing die-offs amongst moose populations across North America, including in New Hampshire. And ecologists and biologists don't really know why. There's sort of different reasons in different places. In some places, it may be because of habitat shrinkage. Other places, because, for example, a beetle-ravaged forest land in Minnesota, and that's really hurt the moose. In New Hampshire, they're seeing moose that are covered with hundreds of thousands of ticks, and they rub off all the ticks and rub off all their hair, and then they lose their hair and they die of hypothermia. I mean, it's horrible. There's something terrible happening to moose across North America, and it's quite heartbreaking, and hopefully scientists will figure out why.
Let's hope. Jim Sturgis, your hubbub.
My hubbub is sort of a case of maybe you should have paid the dishwasher a little more money. It's the closure of the Hilltop Steakhouse and the fact that there are many items that are appearing on eBay, not yet Craigslist. And I would say that while management may have a beef with this kind of behavior, the bigger challenge is to steer clear of the law.
Nicely put, Jim.
Thorny.
And Dante, let me come to you for your hubbub.
Well, in my hubbub, I want to mourn the impending departure of Rounder Records, which is the local roots music label that recently announced that they were moving to Nashville at the beginning of next year. Now, they started off in 1970 as part of the Cambridge folk scene, but they've cast a wider net. Their big star right now is Alison Krauss, who's a bluegrass musician whose record with Robert Plant won 5 Grammys in 2009. Rounder now wants to move deeply into country music, and for better or for worse, Nashville is the place where you do that. It's a loss for Boston, but in any case, here's a song by Alison Krauss and Robert Plant, and it's appropriately called Gone, Gone, Gone.
Gone, Gone. All right, well, somehow we got through Week in Review without mentioning the Red Sox, so I'll make that my hubbub. And here's what I want to say about this. We've had 5 games. They've been all as close as can be. I'm at the age where I feel I don't really need to seek out situations that actually accelerate my aging. So this is what I hate about this coming weekend. But Dante Ramos, deputy editorial page editor of the Boston Globe, and Jim Sturgis, executive director of the Pioneer Institute. Thank you both and have a great weekend.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you.
I have to say, you've got to friend WBUR on Facebook because you can see Bob Oakes, Tom Ashbrook, me, and hopefully when the Sox win Game 4, Anthony Brooks with beards on and Red Sox baseball caps celebrating our march towards the pennant. That's, again, WBUR's Facebook page. Go check it out.
It's a scary site.
Scary, freaky good, I guess. Well, up next, we'll talk about the BSO's new director as he takes the baton for the first time. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty.
And I'm Anthony Brooks. This is Radio Boston.